Great. Thank you, Greg. Thanks, everyone, for coming. Sorry for changing your plans at lunch on Monday. And thanks for being flexible and changing to Friday. LAX hold up. So yeah, so as Greg said, I'm one of the organizers of this program, and I decided to call this summary of what we've been doing, integrating physics and biology. Of course, we've also had a lot of chemistry and some population genetics and some math and some ecology, and you know, I'm sure there are people who feel that there's subfields of science not accurately represented here. We've definitely incorporated philosophy, although that wasn't necessarily on the game plan, but we had to acknowledge that it was creeping in somehow. All of these different approaches to cooperation, and specifically we're interested in how cooperation, which we'll talk more about its definition in a minute, can lead to multicellularity. And I just called it from molecules to superorganisms because I have a bit of an issue with colons and titles. Every single title I write has a colon and a subtitle in it. So the people who have organized this are your very own Greg Huber, who, as you know, comes from the world of biophysics. And Greg and I first met at a meeting that was similar to this program, except it took place only over 2 days. So it was very tiny and compressed. I don't know if we've advanced more in 10 weeks than we did in 2 days, but we've certainly drawn it out longer. We first met at that meeting, which he co-organized together with another physicist and biophysicist and a population geneticist, James Glazier and Mike Lynch, respectively, both of whom have come to participate in the program. So at that program, I met Greg, and the program was a success. It took place at Bloomington, Indiana, in the Biocomplexity Institute 2 years ago. It was very exciting, I think, for all involved. And it was so exciting that Greg had the great idea of doing a really long version of it, essentially. And so I got involved, and I'm Cassandra. And I'm a developmental geneticist. And we also roped in Rick Michaud, who works at University of Arizona. And Rick Michaud is a theoretician and also an experimentalist who works on various transiently multicellular, obligately multicellular, or only unicellular special group of algae that I'll mention a little bit later. And then we had also David Nansimon, who joined us, who has to go back and forth from LA. He drives, so he doesn't get stuck in airports. And David is a physicist and chemist and molecular biologist. So this is just to give you an idea of the different points of view that we brought in when we tried to put this program together, and the group of people, certainly, that our first blast of invitations hit were largely informed, of course, by our interests and knowledge. And then also we wanted to make sure we had people who were covering gaps, areas that we didn't deal with directly. So the purpose of this talk, as I understand it, is to let those of you who haven't necessarily seen what the program is doing, to let you know what it is we are doing. Okay, so this is what I'm going to try to do. And of course, if at any point anything that I'm saying is unclear or too specific or too vague, please feel free to interrupt and let me know. So as I've said, we're interested in cooperation specifically as it applies to multicellularity and the emergence of multicellularity. And multicellularity we find fascinating because we are multicellular, and that's kind of the bottom line justification for most of the stuff that we as a species end up doing. But it's also interesting to note that evolution has produced multicellularity independently many times. So animals, of which we are a tiny portion, are not the only multicellular organisms that exist. They are not the only multicellular eukaryotes that exist, all right? It's also interesting and important to realize that one of the things we've had to struggle with, even though it might seem paradoxical because we put it right in the title, is what is even the definition of multicellularity if a given organism doesn't exhibit it all the time? And there are examples that I'll mention a little bit later of organisms that under certain environmental conditions exist as single cells, and under other environmental conditions exist as multicellular units. And then we have also, I'll add as a developmental biologist, the serious problem of what to do with the knowledge that comes from noticing that a cell that in its natural environment, as far as we're able to observe, only exhibits behaviors A and B, under other conditions that we can impose artificially and experimentally, exhibits behaviors Y and Z. Does this tell us anything about what the cell does in its natural environment? Does it tell us about what ancestors of that cell might have done in a far past that we can never visualize? We have no concrete answers to these things, but they end up coming up. And of course, the other concept that, again, is right in our title, and yet we have to deal with definitions of it every day, is this concept of cooperation, which of course is a word that we borrow from our culture as humans. And when we use this word as humans, we are implying a certain amount of information holding and a certain amount of information transfer and acting consciously on this information. And it is a challenge for us to understand to what extent that definition can apply to other life forms with which we cannot communicate in our own terms, which is basically every other life form except us. Okay. So these are problems that we have. We try to work through them nonetheless. So before I go into what exactly did we get into in our program, I want to tell you about some things that you should be careful of in your thinking as I speak about what we did in the program and that we've had to be very careful of as well. And some of them will be obvious to many of you, and others might be reminders of things that you'd heard before, and others might be new to you. And so I just want to make it clear that when we talk about evolution, we don't mean optimization or optimality. Everything at this microsecond in time has a certain set of features. That does not mean, and these features, let me interrupt myself, have evolved over some amount of time that we can argue about. That does not mean that the features that we observe today or that existed in any previous or any future time are optimal for anything. They might be good. They might be better than some other alternative that you can imagine or even find data for. But we cannot assume a priori that they are optimal for anything. So this is an important piece of thinking that, of course, without thinking about it too much, we can let creep into our thinking. For example, I could say, why do I have five fingers? I can take what my lab likes to call the adaptationist program, right, like the adaptationist industrial complex, and assume that there's something better about five than there is about any other number, right? Because of course we can all know of examples from other organisms or from mutant humans that have different numbers of fingers. But most of us have five fingers. So has anybody heard of The Chrysalids by John Wyndham? Okay, if you don't have five fingers, read the book. It's a great book. It's about a post-apocalyptic. I know. That's right. No one put your hand up now. That's right. I've read it. I have fun. No, it's a fantastic book about post-apocalyptic future, post-nuclear apocalypse, where, of course, incidence of mutations is extremely high, but they choose their breeding groups carefully, humans, so that we don't breed out, keep breeding the mutations. And so anyone with any physical defects is killed at birth, and there's one child who has six toes on one foot, and the parents are trying to hide the child, but then they see the footprints in the sand. Anyway, great book. Okay. So it's classic UK science fiction from the 50s. All right, so let's just keep that in mind, that just because we observe that a plant is green and a flower is red and you have hair or you don't have hair, that this is somehow adaptive, that it confers a fitness benefit, or that it is optimal for any condition, current, past, or present. It might be, but we have no data to support that a priori unless we go in and do some fitness tests. Okay. The other thing that we want to keep in mind is that just because we can observe something existing today, so it exists, does not mean that it is adaptive. Does not mean that the reason that we are alive today is because we have optimally adapted to some kind of environment in the past or in the present. Or even, some people like to imagine the evolution of evolvability as if there were kind of a predictive force to evolution. What niches might I occupy in the future? Let me get prepared for those now. It's very difficult to argue that we have data that supports that view. But it's just important to keep in mind these two interrelated things. The other thing that's important to remember when we're talking about evolution, so evolution, strictly speaking, of course, is going to be changes in features, and we talk about genes because these are common mechanisms of inheriting features. Feature can be whatever you want. It can be a sequence, it can be a phenotype, it can be a disease, it can be the number of hairs you have. We're talking about changes in these features over time that are heritable. And then if you want to get Darwinian on evolution, you can talk about these features being subject to natural selection. So these features are going to be heritable. So there's going to be reproduction of some kind. But reproduction doesn't have to mean sex. Okay, so just remember that you can have asexual reproduction. That means reproduction with no exchange or recombination or shuffling of genetic information or heritable information. You can have asexual reproduction of unicellular organisms. You can have asexual reproduction of multicellular organisms. Okay, asexual reproduction of a unicellular organism hopefully is easy for you to imagine. One cell divides. Nobody else is around. It makes two other cells. Multicellular asexual reproduction might not be that easy to imagine if you're not used to looking at these kinds of things, but you can imagine a coral, for example, a type of coral that might get a little blip on one side of it, and the blip will grow bigger and bigger and then separate off, and now we're going to have two corals. And this blip is not born from a special gonad region or a special germ cell that underwent sex of any kind. So this can also happen. The other thing we want to remember, and this came up yesterday in Faye's talk if you were around, is that sex is not the same as gender. Gender is a human cultural construct. Sex is a physical or a biological distinction between the entities, two or more, that engage in sexual reproduction in exchange of information. Okay. And there are, as Faye also discussed yesterday, there are some species that have two sexes. Humans are one example. There are some species that have more than two sexes. And to my knowledge, there is no pattern in the numbers that we find, 3, 7, 10. There are different types that can come together, but not self, to reshuffle hereditary information.
Can you provide a concrete example of 3 and 7?
Tetrahymena has 7. Tetrahymena is a single-celled organism that is very interesting because it's a single cell, but it has two genomes inside it. One really big nucleus, one really small nucleus. When I say nucleus, I'm referring to concentration of genetic material. There's not clearly some kind of membrane around it. And the big nucleus is like a somatic nucleus. That means it's like the nucleus of all the cells in our body that are not gamete-producing cells, that are not germ cells. And the way in which it is like soma is that when this cell reproduces, when it divides, this genetic material essentially is not passed on, just destroyed. But it is the genetic material that is used for this cell to go about its business and do its everyday things of living the life of a cell. This genetic material, which is like the germline, is not used for the day-to-day life. In a similar way, if you had no sperm and no eggs in your body, you'd still be here eating your lunch, going to bed, talking to your friends. You don't need your reproductive cells to live your life. However, if you don't have your reproductive cells, you're not going to make it. And only your reproductive cells will give rise to offspring, if you're going to have them, genetically related offspring. Okay, you can adopt. All right. So fascinating thing about tetrahymena is that when they going about the business, this is what's used. But when it's time to reproduce, this essentially is destroyed. This expands, and a subset of it is chosen to be the new soma, and a subset of it differentiates as the germline nucleus. You have it again. And they have 7 different mating types, each of which, I believe, can mate with any one of the, so you have 6 choices. Whichever one of these you are.
There's no selfing among them?
There is no there is no selfing. That is correct. There is no selfing. Yeah. So tetrahymena is pretty interesting. Genome was just sequenced, if you're into that kind of thing. It's not clear what it means. Although, one thing that is interesting from the genome is that you might wonder, well, why is it that the germline is not helping with the day-to-day? Does the soma have genes that the germline doesn't? Actually, the reverse is true. In this process of the germline expanding and then making some of its DNA differentiate into a somatic nucleus and some of it differentiate it into a germline nucleus, it actually strips out a bunch of stuff from the somatic genome. So the somatic genome doesn't even have all the real stuff of the animal. Only the germline holds on to that. But the germline is just not using it. It is transcriptionally quiescent. Okay? And this is very similar to a process that occurs not infrequently in animals called chromosome diminution. This is found in vertebrates and in invertebrates in multiple species. And it's a process whereby when the germline nucleus divides, and in early embryogenesis, you have many cells. I'll just use up this space here. Okay, you have lots of cells. Maybe these ones are going to end up making the germline, and the rest are going to be the soma. And it turns out that what happens is that the germline keeps all the original DNA that came in from the gametes that produced this zygote. But the somatic nuclei lose some of it. During early cell divisions and DNA replication, some of the DNA literally gets cut out and destroyed. So they're operating through their lifetimes with less than the total number of possible genes that that this organism has. This is a very common phenomenon. We don't understand how it works. We know something about the signals that say this piece of DNA has got to go, and we can make up stuff about the mechanisms that make it go away, but we don't really know for sure. Okay, so that was a bit of an aside. And then the final thing that we have to be careful with is conflict and cooperation, of course. They're sort of part of our title, but they're very tricky, and they're for similar reasons that it's tricky sometimes, it can be, to remember that sex is not the same as gender, which is that conflict and cooperation imply knowledge and use of knowledge. Those are the ways in which we use them in our society. And when we observe cells or atoms or molecules or herds of whatever you like, buffalo, and we observe their behaviors, we need a language to describe their behaviors, what we try to do in science, whether your language is words or mathematics. And if you're unfortunate enough to be not a mathematician, then you have to use words that are in the language that you use to describe how you feel about your neighbor, and we use words like this. And it's just important to remind ourselves, I think, that we cannot ascribe the same type of information content and intent as we have, or we hope we have, when we conflict and cooperate with each other, to these other entities that we observe. All right. So we started off the program by dealing a little bit with some of the theoretical frameworks. Many of them include mathematical treatments that have been used to try and explain and predict various features, various dynamics that we observe in biological systems and also in non-biological systems. And that's where approaching these problems from more than just a biological perspective is handy. And so one, these are not the only ways to do this, but these are some of the ways that we've looked at in our program. One of the frameworks that's been used to try and explain and predict conflicts and how those conflicts will resolve, or what the results of these conflicts will be, is game theory, which was developed ostensibly for economic purposes quite a while ago, not super long ago, in sort of 20s, 30s, but then it's been applied to many things. It was really big in applications to evolutionary biology in the 70s and 80s, and John Maynard Smith is a famous biologist who published a paper in 73 discussing the use of this framework, and then a very influential book in 1982 also discussing the application of this framework to understanding what appear to be conflict and cooperative behaviors in animal, in evolution, let's just say, in biological evolution. And so the basic concept of this is to try and develop a set of solutions that will always emerge when you play a particular type of game. And so the common one that was introduced in his book is one where you have a hawk and a dove playing a game. Okay, because we're anthropomorphizing everything, you can imagine that the hawk is, you know, mercenary and bad and aggressive, and the dove is peaceful and, you know, non-aggressive and chicken and cowardly. Okay, so the idea is to say, okay, if I'm a hawk and I can only be aggressive, what can I do? I'm a hawk. That's the only thing I know how to do. Then I'm going to meet somebody on the road. It's going to be a hawk or a dove. I only have one behavior that I exhibit all the time, and what is it? What are going to be the outcomes for me in terms of what I win, my benefit, and what I lose, my cost, when I engage in this activity? And so if I meet another hawk, I'm going to fight, and the hawk is going to fight too, because that's all we can do. And so whatever benefit we gain from fighting, we're going to split equally, because neither of us is going to win, because we're equally matched. And so whatever benefit is available, we're going to have to split it in two. Now, if I'm a hawk and I meet a dove, the dove is going to lose Okay, so I'm going to get all the benefits. Okay.
Now find a dove.
And I meet a hawk. So these values here are from the perspective of the player. Okay. So I'm a dove. I meet a hawk. I'm going to lose. I have zero benefit. Okay. If I meet another dove, oh, it's so nice. Okay. So, right, we're both making peace. So we're going to take the benefit. But there is going to be some cost of us interacting. And whatever benefit is left over, we're going to split it equally. Because, you know, nobody's winning or losing really here. So whatever the outcome is. So this is one example. And then there are many, many other variations on this. Of course, you can imagine multiplayer games. And I think we're going to have a talk about multiplayer games on Friday from Chaitanya Gokhale. You can imagine games where benefits and costs might interrelate to each other. You can imagine situations where, okay, I was born a hawk, but I went to a good school, and now I can be like a dove if I want to, right? So you can imagine facultative choices, right, of behaviors that depend on whatever you want, depend on the history, depend on the cost-benefit involved. Okay, and variations of this were taken up in mathematical treatments of bullying, which is one of the case examples that we've had. So this is
yes. There no cost there for fighting?
Is there no cost for fighting? Yes, you could do that. You could do that as well. You could build that in. Yep. So this was one of the things that we opened with, and we discussed it. And there are many, you know, you can take at least two different viewpoints. You can say this is a 40-year-old framework for explaining evolutionary behaviors or the evolution of behaviors. And so, if the theory is true, then I should be able to observe it in my plate of yeast or my dish of fungi or whatever it is that you love the best that you like to look at. And so you have a set of studies that take this approach. They say, I'm going to assume that the predictions of game theory are holding true, and I'm going to look to see if I can find behaviors that fit this model. And of course you can, right? Does this mean the game theory is true? I mean, what other ways do we have to really provide support for a hypothesis? It's tough to know. But there are other ways of looking at it, which are that because of the difficulty of defining things like benefit and cost, right, which we're going to get into here, it can be very difficult to know if a priori we should assume that games are being played under the predictions that game theory gives us. And so these are some of the discussions that we've had. But that's one framework.
Sorry, isn't the way to evaluate a theory to look for a falsification of that theory?
Exactly.
So what's the falsifiability of games?
It's very tough to know what it is. And I would say that a little bit because of the history and the victors issue, we have many more cases, to my knowledge, of observations that have been claimed to support the theory than have been claimed to falsify it. Yeah. So another thing that people love to scratch their heads about is altruism, right? Which automatically assumes an element of conflict and cooperation involved in whatever set of dynamics you're talking about. And so the concept of altruism is, why would I do something for you if I have no perceived benefit? Why would I give this talk when I could be revising a grant that was due 2 hours ago, right? What am I getting out of it, right? And so one of the frameworks that's been used to try and explain and predict altruism is kin selection, which goes back to this concept that that heritable features that are going to be passed on, which I'd really like to pass on my heritable features because they're mine, but if you have at least some of the same heritable features that I have, which you might have if you're related to me, then maybe it's going to be worth my while to some degree to help you out, because at least that way some of my material will make it to the next generation, even if it's not all of it, which I would get if I deposited it, right? And I might have, yeah, okay, let's just leave it at that. So, Hamilton's rule is one of the most famous frameworks that is used to suggest this. So Hamilton was an evolutionary biologist working in the 60s, and he suggested that, look, if I have benefit and cost, I need the benefit to outweigh the cost of my behavior, and the degree to which this is the case is going to depend on how related I am to the person I am helping, and that's your relatedness. It's important to note that relatedness is not the same as what degree of cousin are you from me. In this framework, it is used as it's a probability. It's a probabilistic function that describes the probability that you would share the heritable characteristics as opposed to a random distribution of these characteristics, which of course has some connection to what degree of cousin are you from me, but it's not directly translatable. So this is one framework that has been used over and over again, many cases, and many people have claimed, it goes back to the point of falsifiability, that this is not necessarily a predictive framework, it's rather a sort of a bookkeeping exercise. A paper came out only 2 years ago that claimed to have the first, since the 60s, the first data collected from a wild data set in support of this, right? Because of what happens, the problem is, we're going to get to this when we get to our problems, some of our problems, that these things are very difficult to quantify, and the values that you obtain for them are going to depend, of course, largely on the types of experiments that you do. And we'll get to that when we talk about cost. But just to talk about relatedness, for example, how should I quantify my relatedness to Greg? Should I sequence our genomes and accounting for the proportion of single nucleotide polymorphisms? I should take the proportion of nucleotide sequences that are different. Should I take it over the whole genome? Should I take it over just the coding regions of genes because we think those are where the action is? Should I take it only from the transposable elements that are lying dormant because maybe selection is acting differently there and that's a better readout of something? How good was my sequencing technology? Can I even distinguish a SNP from a sequencing error? The answer is almost never. So how should I even calculate this? So it's not obvious. Okay, a cost and benefit are even worse. Okay.
You think, I don't know about bacteria.
Yes.
You think remote insects?
Yes. Yes. And in fact, many organisms engage in incest all the time. We find it problematic, maybe, to think about because we have a cultural taboo against it. But most laboratory organisms are doing it all the time. Incest, cannibalism, whatever you like. It's not a big deal. We're the weird ones out, right? We're losing out, right? Okay. And it's so much easier, right? We spend so much time looking for food and mates, okay? Anyway, we haven't discussed those issues too much. Okay. So people have wanted to find frameworks to understand and predict how alleles are going to change or how behaviors, whatever the trait is that you're looking for, let's say it's heritable, how these things are going to change over time. And so one framework that has been used for that has been, it's called the Price equation. And Price was basically just rederiving Hamilton's rule a few years later and came up with a slightly different spin on it. And essentially, in its simplest form, again, you can have lots of variations. Carl Simpson told us about some of those this morning. In its simplest form, it's a covariance relationship that tells you that the change over time in some phenotype, okay, or some allele or some behavior, whatever it is you're able to track or interested in tracking, is going to have a relationship with the covariance of the fitness value for that trait and the trait value itself, when you compare different generations, successive generations to each other. So in a way, what this tells you is that if certain alleles or traits covary in a positive way with the fitness that they confer, then these alleles will increase over time. Okay. So that's the sort of super reductionist view of the Price equation. And again, you can build in many, many components of it, right? For example, if I want to calculate my fitness and imagine how it will change over time in my future generations, then what aspect of my fitness do I need to consider, right? Is it my height or my charming smile or my number of eggs that are still good, or, you know, what is it? So there are many problems, but you could try and build in extra terms to account for all these different levels of fitness, and people do. And then finally, I just want to mention something because it comes up a lot, and because Fisher was a very important geneticist who wrote a very famous book in the 30s. And he discussed many aspects of what is considered now foundational population genetics and mathematical treatments of genetic dynamics. And it's not so much a sort of a theorem, it's just kind of a statement that the rate of fitness increase of an organism has some strong relationship with its genetic variance. Okay, in fitness. Okay. So in simple language, it's been interpreted, certainly in undergraduate textbooks, as the concept that the larger the fitness landscape you have to choose from, the more likely you are to be able to take a step up in fitness at the next step. Okay. Again, it's not really a mathematical theorem, but it's sort of a concept that's been used a lot. Interesting anecdote, Fisher was a strong eugenicist. Okay, so he believed very strongly in making sure that rich, well-educated people had lots of offspring, but that poor, uneducated people did not have lots of offspring, because otherwise there's more of them, they have more babies, they're definitely going to take over, it's going to be bad. That chapter, which is the last chapter of his original book, was eliminated by the third edition. But you can still get it if you get a first edition. I give sections of that chapter to my graduate students in a class on genetics and evolution as an essay question, and I ask them to discuss this hypothesis, and I don't tell them what the source is, and to discuss whether it makes sense or not, given what they've learned about it or not. Okay, so, say it again?
What did they say?
Oh, well, I mean, this was, I made the mistake of incorporating that in a take-home exam, and so most of them were savvy enough to just Google the words, right? I don't think we didn't have anybody saying, yeah, that totally makes sense, definitely a good idea. We did have people saying, well, it's kind of hard to argue with, right? Because if the numbers are the numbers, but then probably I couldn't do those experiments because the human protocols, the approvals would be nightmarish paperwork. Practical. Okay. Very pragmatic student. Okay.
Sorry,
peanut. Oh, no. These are all supposedly in, you know, grad school. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. They're probably making a lot of money right now. All right, so here are some problems that we've had to deal with, and I've alluded to a lot of these already, and we've literally had conversations of the nature of what is it? What is cost, for example? Is cost the number of calories that I need to expend to give this talk? Is it the number of years off my lifespan that I just took by smoking a cigarette? You know, what is it? Is it the number of my children that will be killed if I, you know, move to Iran? Well, what is it? Okay. Is it a concept which is going to be qualitative and perhaps useful, or is it a parameter that I can quantify, right, or at least define a space for? It's not super clear, it's not obvious. The same thing applies to benefit, right, and we want to talk about these things all the time. And when I say want, I actually mean that, because I'm talking about what we want, not about what any other biological entity wants, because we don't know what they want, right? But we want, in our quest to ascribe meaning to ourselves and to the world, and order, at the very least, if not meaning, we want to understand, we imagine that things are costly and that other things might be beneficial and less costly. And so deciding how to incorporate these things into quantitative treatments of evolution is very challenging. Similarly, we have discussions about fitness every other day. We have an idea that they must incorporate somehow the elements of cost and benefit, some equation that includes the cost and the benefits. The residual will give you the fitness, maybe. But then we have discussions, just this morning we had another iteration of it. What kind of value is this? If it is a parameter, what is it? Right? You could apply this to cost and benefit as well. Is it a scalar? Okay, is it a discrete value? Is it a vector? Okay, it includes more than one. Okay, is it a tensor? Okay. There's no clear resolution on this, but you can imagine that it might be important to try to sort this out a little bit, particularly if you want to have a quantitative treatment or a predictive framework for it, because it depends very much on how you're going to construct this model, and that relates a little bit to other discussions that we've had. I won't call them conflict, but I think they've been good discussions about the relative uses and places of data and theory and the interactions between them. And so I'm just going to caricature a couple of the extreme views we've had. One extreme view is that no theories or predictive simulation frameworks should be constructed in the absence of data or parameter spaces that are obtained from the real biological world. Right, so if you don't know how many babies squirrels normally have on a given day or in a given month, then you should not start to create a theory that's going to provide you a predictive simulation of the squirrel population over time. You need the real data first. Okay, another caricatured extreme view is that data from the natural world, largely biological data, are so few and far between that they cannot give us any indication of what real parameter space is for these values. We've only studied a tiny fraction of all, whatever you want, species, genes, genomes, organelles that exist and that have existed. So who cares what we think the real values are, because we don't really know, right? We know about two species of this and one species of that. So let's just parameterize. Let's just make parameter spaces that we think are reasonable or that cover every conceivable value, and let's work within those frameworks. So again, I'm caricaturing. Nobody actually said those words. That was my translation of what was being said. So So we have these real issues to grapple with. And I think this is part of what explains some of what can look like circularity and repetition of experiments. Like, hasn't that experiment already been done before? Well, yes, but, you know, X was missing. Okay. We have difficulty also discussing selection to a certain degree. Many mathematical treatments, particularly population genetics, have been really powerful to help us predict changes in allele frequencies over time, changes maybe even in genome architecture over time. And so population genetics treatments have been very helpful for those things. What they've been less helpful for us to understand is what the nature of selection is. And there's a selection term built into all population genetics, but how do you tell how strongly selection is acting, right? I'm under selective pressure to publish papers so I don't lose my job. How strong is that? Is that stronger than the selective pressure I'm under to smoke cigarettes or not so that I'll live longer? It's very difficult to quantify these things. It's very difficult for us to know what the selective pressures even might be, let alone how strong they are, because these things will depend on environments and times, and we can only know some of the data about extant or recent environments. And so this is something that we struggle with a lot. Maybe it seems weird that we also have trouble defining sometimes what individuals are, or what organisms are, or what species are, or even what multicellularity is, given that we put it in the title of our program. But the reality is that we do. So if I have a cancerous tumor, I don't think I do, but actually I have a thyroid goiter, so it's benign. So it's a small lump in my thyroid that apparently is doing nothing, is what they say. So what is that? Is that an individual? It's not cooperating with the rest of my body. They're not thyroid cells. They're not producing thyroid hormone. They're not doing the things they're supposed to be doing. I don't know what they really are doing. But if they're in the thyroid, but they're not of the thyroid, then what are they? If they're not doing what the other cells around them are doing, might they be subject to their own sets of costs and benefits and fitnesses, therefore undergoing different levels of selection, different natures of selective pressures, and operating in ways that the rest of my body or the other organs of my body do not? Should I call that goiter an organism or not? Many people would agree or come close to agreeing, even if they don't want to use that word, that if a unit experiences selection discretely, that means independently, doesn't have to be associated with something else, then we can consider it an organism. But because organism has connotations of things that are bounded by epithelia, it's difficult for us to think of the blob as an organism. It seems, you know, I think these are really anthropomorphic hang-ups. One concept that's become popular to get away from the baggage of the word organism is individual. And just to talk about individuals or individuality and their capability to be selected upon. And then it is easier to stomach talking about selection on individual genes or on individual genomes or genome architectures or on individual cells or subcomponents of cells, the different organelles that are inside a cell. So individuality and organismality are concepts that have arisen in the field in the last 15, 20 years in sort of using these particular words and that have been useful for avoiding some of the issues about what an organism is or isn't. But in a similar way, we have a not trivial problem in defining what a species is and saying to what extent that's useful. I think I'm a different species from the crickets that I study in my lab. We also study fruit flies in my lab. We have studied two different species of fruit flies, which in the lab don't hybridize. If you offer them mates from the other species, they don't like it. But in the wild, there are a small population of flies that literally have genomic hybrids of some of the genome of one of them and some of the genomes of the other ones. And this divergence, or this merging, I should say, is so recent that you can trace them almost nucleotide by nucleotide and say, oh, that one's from that one and that one's from that one. And they're mixed up together in some kind of weird transporter accident. And, right, you know what I'm talking about. And these hybrids will only mate with each other. They won't mate with either of the parent species. They don't do it in the wild, and we offer them in the lab. They don't want to do it. So what are they? Are they a species? Or how different does their DNA have to get before we call it a species? How often do they have to occasionally say, okay, I'll mate with this one because there's nobody else around. It's been 10 days before we say, oh, there's a reproductive barrier. These are open questions in evolutionary biology, and so we need to consider the species problem. It can be a problem for us. Conflict and cooperation I've already dealt with. To simplify it, We run the risk of anthropomorphizing if we assume that behaviors that appear to occur collectively are the result of action-informed decision-making, or behaviors that appear to occur to be in an exclusionary way are informed by active decision-making. They may be, they may not be. Sometimes we can find genetic evidence for this, sometimes we can't. And then multicellularity is a tough one, right? So we have organisms, as I've said before, that under certain conditions are unicellular, under others are multicellular. The costs and benefits and relative fitnesses of those different types of existence are difficult, because here's where you get in, you say, well, look, maybe I really do need more than one dimension because it's environment dependent. So I need to at least build that in. And so this is pretty interesting, right? And I'll tell you in the last couple of minutes about a case study from Brad Olson where he, if you like, he made something that normally is only unicellular be multicellular. So normally I'm a cell, I'm dividing, one daughter goes that way, another daughter goes that way, we're all fine. Still unicellular. Now what if my daughter remains physically stuck to me, okay, like a conjoined twin, okay? I'm now multicellular, I mean by definition, right? More than one cell. So Brad has managed to create this. What should we call that? Is that multi, you know, we don't, the reality is our bodies emerge in exactly that way. The cells remain stuck to each other. And you can argue about what the nature of the junction is and how important it is that it have this junction or that junction. The reality is if you, by virtue of your cell division processes, remain stuck, then we're going to call you multicellular. But the fact that we can sometimes observe this as a transient state within the same organism or species, if you like, natural populations, gives us some problems. I think there was going to be a question. No?
But you said you had 5 minutes, so I thought I shouldn't interrupt.
That's okay.
Okay, well, so as far as modeling and, you know, how you do modeling, I mean, it's like this kind of question that you're raising happens in applied mathematics over and over, because in applied math, you know, you jump between fields and, you know, you don't necessarily have the kind of preconceptions that someone from a specific field has. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you always start with the simplest model possible,
right,
with some reasonable amount of predictive power that's also falsifiable,
right,
and then you build in features progressively, and all of those models are useful. It's not like, you know, one model is wrong, the other is
absolutely
right. Kind of occur in layers.
Yes.
So when you're saying scalar vector tensor, I mean, that can all be the answer, right? Where,
yes,
you know, scalar gives you some amount of information, now
that's
you need
right
information to encompass this other situation, and then you have these kind of nested
that's right
kind of nested approach. So
that's
is
right.
Is that how you guys are thinking? Or
I think, you know, on my optimistic days, if that's exactly what has been happening, that I completely agree with you personally that these different types of approaches give us different types of information and they're not mutually exclusive with respect to their informative power. And so I think that what I found very useful about the meeting, and I hope others have as well, is that we're all working from a given framework or with a given set of assumptions or with models that have more or fewer parameters, but we're seeing the utility of different approaches and different definitions of fitness, for example. And I think that they are all adding to our understanding rather than causing us to be very confused. So I think you're absolutely right. Yeah.
But it should be also possible, as I mentioned, to disprove specific models. So do you have a case where someone proposes a model and then it's disproven and thrown out?
That's a very good question. I think that we have very good examples of that from the mechanistic aspects of biology, from how things happen, right? So how is it that my hand has five fingers, right? I can think maybe I was born with a paddle where my feet is, you know, it was a paddle and then the cells in the middle were lasered out, okay? Or there were five different projections that grew and I can falsify either one of those hypotheses by just observing the embryo, right? And I can make hypotheses about which genes need to do it, and I can falsify that. I think we have great difficulty falsifying evolutionary hypotheses that try to address how things happened in times that we can no longer observe. And I think we also have great difficulty falsifying hypotheses about the why questions in evolution that ultimately, in some sense, are asking these questions. What is the cost? What is the benefit? And what, based on what costs or benefits I think are involved, should I expect to happen? So I think this is part of what we've been grappling with. So I think the answer is yes, we have many, many examples of falsifiable hypotheses from the mechanistic how version of things, but it's much more difficult to find them from the why version of things. Yeah. All right, so in the last couple of minutes, I'll just tell you about a couple of case studies that people have brought up in the different levels at which we've explored cooperation and its contribution at different levels to multicellularity. So people have looked at cooperation within molecules, all right? For example, we can talk, Eugene, these are just initials of people to remind myself of what was happening, not secret codes. Okay, Eugene Jankovich told us about some interesting studies he's been doing to try and understand what kinds of chemical and physical forces control and predict the interactions of different parts of a protein with themselves, okay, with each other, and the interaction of different proteins with each other. And so he comes from a physics background, but is essentially doing some serious chemistry at this stage to try and use concepts of physics to understand these chemical natures that deal with cooperation between pieces of the same molecule. We also had Pierre Durand and Irene Chen, who's here on the faculty, talking to us about the properties of cooperation between molecules or the cooperation of a molecule with itself. So a self-replicator, you've probably all heard of this concept of the RNA world, that what was the first molecule? Maybe it was RNA, maybe it could replicate itself. It had all these base pairs, they look so attractive, they could fold on each other, they have these hydrogen bonds. Okay, so they talked about the different properties of RNA molecules, fitness of molecules as measured by some assay that you make up in the lab. Okay, the ability of molecules to do simple operations that we think were important for the creation of life, what we're calling us, let's say. Okay, simple operations like joining up two previously unjoined strands of nucleic acid, or operations like making another copy of a nucleic acid strand. And so with some really interesting chemical and molecular biology techniques, Irene and Pierre can design molecules that have these properties that, of course, are great, difficult to falsify. Question or hypothesis is, to what extent are these activities that we observe in these molecules in the lab, to what extent did they participate in creating the molecules that we have today? This is very difficult to know. We've had nice examples of cooperation between molecules. So Mike Lynch was talking about some ideas he had in progress about understanding why many proteins, when they do a job, they don't do it in isolation. They have to form dimers. That means they have to have two copies of each other stuck to each other in a particular way to then do their job. And of course, you have dimers, you have multimers of different numbers. Actually, you almost never get trimers, apparently, just counting what we know. So he was really interested in, essentially, is there a significance to the fact that most proteins appear to operate in dimers? Or is it a consequence of non-adaptive, so not due to selective pressure, but just due to population genetic distribution of alleles and properties of stickiness in proteins, that we should actually just expect to find this? Yeah?
So actually there are trimers, I would say quite a few. So the most abundant protein in, for example, in the human body is collagen, and that's a trimer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not clear to me why people go to that.
I don't know if human collagens, if other non-human collagens are also trimeric, but the data that he presented was looking at multimeric states of proteins from all kingdoms of life, and humans make up such a small proportion of the biomass that I wouldn't be surprised if that might be the explanation. Yeah.
From a genetic point of view, I think he's right in the sense that these are just a few genes that make the trimers, but it depends how you do the counting. Do you count it in terms of genes that whose products form trimers, or do you count it in terms of, let's say, look at the mass of the animal, the protein mass of the individual, and see what's there?
He was talking about all known proteins from all kingdoms of life, what proportion of them form multimers of different dimensions. And so in his calculation, trimers were small.
But he wasn't talking about copy number.
Correct. Not copy number of genes. Just the protein exists. Who knows how many genes encoded for it? But there it is. Are you going to bond with one of you?
Collagen, yeah. It's extremely abundant. It's not only in humans. It's not only in humans. I mean, collagen is all around.
Correct. But are all collagens trimers? Or are only human collagens trimers?
No, they're all trimers. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's an exception, but I would say that's safe to say that most collagens are trimers.
I am sure that they were included in his calculation, but as I said, he was accounting for all proteins of all life types, and these were simply the numbers that he gave us. We want to talk about cooperation between organelles within a cell. And so a guy named Dave Smith didn't address this directly, but he talked about the architecture of mitochondrial genomes. So mitochondria, just so you remember, you probably learned in grade 2 that they were the powerhouse of the cell. What does that mean? Okay. They're little membrane-bound organelles that we think, in a theory developed primarily by Lynn Margulis. People told her she was crazy. Turned out she was probably right. We have a lot of evidence to think that it's right. Used to be prokaryotic, independently living life forms that invaded a eukaryotic cell, the nucleus. Okay, and they have their own genome, right? And they do a lot of things without which you can't live. Most eukaryotes have plastids of some kind, mitochondria, the special kind we have. Plants have chloroplasts, you've probably heard of those. They make chlorophyll, they make plants green, you've probably noticed that about plants. So Dave talked about, so the contribution of the mitochondrial genome is important. We need the products of our mitochondrial genome to survive. Every organism that has plastids appears to need its plastid genome to survive. And we know much less about the evolution and the architecture of these genomes. By architecture, I mean what genes do they have and in what shapes are the genes put together? What order are they put together? What is the nature of the sequences that's in there? That's what we mean by architecture. What's the nature of the architecture in here? We focus a lot on the nuclear genome because we think that has most of the stuff that makes us who we are that we want to know. But the cool thing about mitochondrial genomes is they're so tiny, it's actually way easier to get data on them for sequencing reasons than it is to get data on nuclear genomes. So what, and I do this as a circle, this mitochondrial genome, and of course, you know, what Dave pointed out is that most of us were taught that mitochondrial genomes are circular. Isn't that weird? So interesting. Ours are linear, and they're in pieces, okay, like strings. But what he did was show that when he surveys a large number of different plastid genomes, you can have all different types of shapes. They can have many chromosomes, they can be linear, they can be circular, they can be linear, they can be all kinds of weird combinations. We don't know exactly what this means for cooperation between plastids and cells, but at least it's a little bit of information that we might be able to start to do some maybe population genetics on or functional studies. Okay, I'll just skip ahead to what we, so all this, the predominance of weird codes here in number four should highlight the fact that really most of the contributions we've had to the program have been discussing cooperation features or behaviors between cells. Okay, so we have lots of cells in a population, and how are they behaving towards each other? Let's say, okay, I'm being anthropomorphic here, or together. Do they appear to be competing? Are some of them producing what we call public goods that the other ones might want to use? What if the other ones don't produce the public good, but they just use up what the other cells do? Are they cheating? If so, is there an advantage? Are they going to win in the end? Are there going to be more of them or not? And one of the reasons that we're really interested in how cells interact and the physical dynamics, the chemical dynamics that control that, and the genes that direct these activities is because we are made of many cells that stick together in an obligate way. Okay, you're all shedding skin every day, but more or less your cells are sticking together. And we think that going from not being together to being together is multicellularity. So we want to know how our cells are behaving with each other. And I've already mentioned one experiment that was done that Brad Olson told us about, where he was looking at a group of algae called vulvocene algae. There are many different types of algae in this group. Some of them are unicellular, some of them are multicellular, but they don't have very many cells. Some of them are multicellular, they have lots and lots of cells. Okay. Some of them are multicellular, and as Christian Solari told us just the other day, once you get to be multicellular in this group and you grow over some certain size, not only do you have lots of cells, but you have division of labor between your cells. Some of your cells do some things that the other cells can't do and don't do, and that thing is reproductive specialization. Okay, so in other words, they behave as a germline. So at least in this group, you get over a certain size threshold, or at least that's the parameter that we can correlate here, and you get to this. And actually, just this morning, Carl Simpson told us about some observations that he's made on a macro level, looking across animals, and also found evidence to suggest, and Sergei Gavriletz, who came and talked to us about bullying, but in the past, he's worked on the evolution of germline soma reproduction. He's also observed in mathematical simulations that once you get up to a certain size of multicellularity, the first division of labor that appears to evolve is the germline soma distinction. And after that, perhaps, you generate other types of division of labor, like photoreceptors and motor neurons and whatever you want. So one cool thing that Brad did, which too, as far as we know, is the first time that someone's done this, is he's taken, he said, well, what's the difference between these guys and these guys? Could I make these guys be multicellular? So he did some transcriptomics and some fancy stuff, and he identified a gene that he had some reason to believe could be helpful, and he took the gene from here, and he put it into here, and what he got was a multicellular of this guy. They failed at a particular point in cell division, and so they ended up stuck together. Okay, now, we don't know anything about the lives or happinesses or evolutionary contributions of this type of scenario, but at least it's a way for us to start to understand at the genetic level what is the difference between staying together or coming together and going away. And let me just address the coming together before I end. Of course, we're also interested in scenarios like slime molds, which under certain conditions are all unicellular. Then under other conditions, they start to aggregate together. They'll all come in from the surrounding whatever. They hear the call. They come in, and the call is literally a chemical that has been identified, and we know that it is emitted in a concentration gradient, and it has concentration-dependent effects. They will come in. They will hear the call. A certain number of them will show up. After that number, more don't join. The call is shut off. That number is very interesting. We don't know what controls that number, and the number is different in different species. So a certain number come together, the right number come together, and then they undergo what we in the animal world would call development. They undergo a morphogenesis, a change of shape, and they create a multicellular structure that has very different differentiated parts. They have a stalk, and they have a spore area, and the spore area is going to make gametes, okay, babies. And this area is going to die. Okay? Not unlike you. Most of your body is going to die. If you have children, your gametes will live on. Their genomes will live on. But this is a facultative response to certain environmental changes. And so we've had people contributing on the genetic control of this, on the population genetic dynamics involved in this, and on the physics and chemical dynamics possibly involved in this step here and in this morphogenetic step here and in these decisions to basically live or die. So I think that's it for time, but I hope you've gotten an idea of what we've been doing here, and I hope that it's been useful, and that you should come to our last week of talks. We have our last week, unfortunately, next week, but you're obviously all welcome to come.
Thanks, Cassandra, for your tour of our program, and if anyone has any doubts, this kind of tour de force summarizing 9 weeks of material is very hard to do. So at the end, we're going to thank you again, but let's take some questions.
Yeah.
Yes.
Eric. One, a little bit off what you said, but just the question of sentience and this multicellular cooperativity.
Mm-hmm.
So is there any notion about the emergence of sentience, mind, et cetera, from these principles?
So there are a couple of things that came up that are a little bit relevant to that. One is the evolution of self, non-self recognition, which in a way is related to a self-awareness, which I guess you could call sentience. And so we had some interesting discussions from Eugene Koonin, who works on the origins of eukaryotes and the origins of their genes and genomes, discussing the possibility that their response to viral invasion might actually be an evolutionary adaptation of an ancient program that was used for immunity, okay, which makes sense. It's a self, non-self. But he discussed the specific molecular ways in which this might have happened. So we've had quite a bit of discussion on the molecular level of the self, non-self distinction. We've also, in the many studies of range expansions and collaborative cell dynamics, or apparently collaborative cell dynamics, have observed that in swarms of cells, for example, cells in different regions of the swarm, if you like, exhibit different behaviors. And there's been discussion as to what exactly is it that gives a cell awareness of that. Is it interaction with other cells? Is it interaction with non-cellular environmental cues? So there's been, I think, the self-non-self thing is one of the closest ways that we've come to addressing your question. And the other thing that I will address, it is not about sentience at all, but it's about vision, which you could argue we need for sentience, whatever. But it was the Ken Kozik, also on the faculty here, discussed his discovery of a particular group of microRNAs, which are a special gene that repress other genes, a special group of microRNAs that appear to be a recent evolutionary innovation. In the higher primates, us basically, and chimps, that are specific to a specific region of the brain that we have that lower primates don't have, and that inform the formation of that particular area of the brain. And we have that area of the brain, and what it does for us is it allows us to see in a slightly different way than lower primates. So it's not sentience, but it's addressing the nervous system. So that's as close as we've come, but we really haven't addressed that question of sentience directly.
About anthropomorphism, I know that everybody, you know, says, okay, we're trying to take that out of the equation here, but then everybody uses the words in a very anthropomorphic way.
Yeah.
Does it matter?
I think it matters. I think we're fooling ourselves if we think that the language we use doesn't influence the thoughts that we have and the actions that we take, no matter. Say it again.
What's an example of where it matters?
Well, I think our discussion of cheaters, this term cheaters.
Yes.
Yeah, that's probably a good example.
Once you use the word cheater, altruist, you're done, basically.
Yeah, so cheaters definitely doesn't have any positive connotations in our culture, but we use it all the time to discuss cells that that appear to obtain a benefit from other cells but not contribute to that benefit, that public good.
Yes.
And I think that's an example of where, and even the words conflict and cooperation, we observe, we as humans, of course, are obsessed with conflict. We do it all the time. It's basically what we do best. And so when we observe a group of more than one things, especially from an evolutionary point of view, because Darwin's ideas have been oversimplified to this survival of the fittest concept, which is very popular but incorrect. And so because of those things, I think we assume immediately, as soon as there's more than one of us in a room and we think that Darwinian evolution is happening, there's a conflict and we have to explain it. And if there's not a conflict, that means there's cooperation, and what's that doing there? That doesn't make any sense. So those are the starting premises that we, that, you know, 50%, 80% of the first slide in a talk is going to be just stating the fact that conflict needs to be understood, and that cooperation, if it exists, needs to be explained. I think that's one way in which it informs us. Okay.
So motivation, it really is different than a random walk with selection applied.
Right, right.
Question,
yes.
Can we discuss the probability of life to appear from some kind of molecules which are not life?
We did not directly address that question. We addressed it only from the chemical sense of assuming that molecules did exist, simple RNA molecules, and then asking what the probability was that they could perform certain functions. But the probability of their coming into being at all, we did not address directly. One thing that it's not molecular existence, but it is the existence of the genetic code, is something that we did address directly. Nigel, what's his name?
Goldenfeld.
That's right, that's right. Nigel discussed the emergence of the genetic code and the chances that it could have emerged to be something other than what it is, and the degree to which it is optimized for including the most amount of information and the smallest amount of parameters. So, but we did not directly address the question that you're asking.
Irene Chen also discussed the RNA world.
That's right, and RNA fitness, but always starting from the point of view that a molecule exists, and now if I have variations on this molecule, what are their relative fits at doing certain things?
Yeah, question the second round and then the first.
Okay, so I think, you know, I'm a physicist. Non-physicists read, you know, people like Lawrence Krauss, and they get a certain view of physics. And non-biologists read people like Neil Wilson or whatever and get a certain view of biology. So I happened to be reading this book, Social Conquest of Earth, this one, and then I went back and looked at this paper he published in Nature Science, I think it's Nature, and 137 people read a rejection of the paper, which is very shocking for a physicist to see. Can you explain the situation? In fact, he specifically mentions Hamilton's rule in his paper.
Right, yeah.
And he uses a lot of the concepts that you're talking about, but of course his cells, you know, are basically ants. That's what he bases everything on, is ants and termites. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I noticed you didn't go to that level. This MC means
multicellular
organisms. Okay, so does that include, you know?
Yeah, so we did some social insects stuff. We talked about the Novak Wilson Tarnita paper every day for the first 2 weeks, and I think people got tired of it. But yeah, you're right. It was a very it was a very controversial paper. And so what this paper was basically saying, so this concept of kin selection that people have brought in and Hamilton's rule, the idea is that in order for me to know what my fitness is, I can't just consider myself and my genes, but I need to consider where are the rest of my genes, right? I have three siblings. They have some of my genes. So my inclusive fitness also includes their fitness plus the fitness of their children plus the fitness of my children if I ever have children. So, so this, adding up all the fitnesses, is the concept of inclusive fitness. And for a long time, people, proponents of kin selection, have said that the key measure that we need to keep in mind is the inclusive fitness. And basically what that paper showed, and neither Wilson nor Novak agreed to come here, but Karina Tarnita, who's the mathematician who did the work, the mathematical work in that paper, did come and talk a little bit about it. What they suggested was that inclusive fitness is not always, or maybe not even necessarily, a useful way to understand why altruism occurs and why between multicellular organism interactions occur the way that they do, and altruism is a big one, and reproductive division of labor based on the caste system in the case of the hymenopterans that he studies. And I think that I'm also slightly outside this field. I'm not really an evolutionary biologist, but I think that the strength of the argument against comes from the fact that kin selection, since it was introduced as a concept, has really been assumed to be the driving force by so many people. That there was an outcry, and I think they were also perceived as stating too strongly that inclusive fitness was a useless concept. People felt they should have moderated that to say the behaviors that we observe in these bee colonies are not usefully explained by inclusive fitness theories, but perhaps there could be others where it's totally fine. So I think that's where a lot of the vitriol came from. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, my question was somewhat similar. It had to do with ethology. Is at a higher level, but this distinction between anthropomorphism and reality seems to me very blurry. Things I've read. It's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
But
in ethologies.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. It is very blurry because in behaviors we think we know why we exhibit certain behaviors, but what we often do in ethology is not only try to understand how certain behaviors are produced, what are the motor neurons that fire that make me move my muscles in a certain way, but why does one animal, you know, why can humans serve a tennis ball well and rats can't? So I think that, this is just my personal opinion, I'm not dragging anyone else into this. I think that when we try to address why questions in science, this is when we anthropomorphize to a dangerous level. I'm not saying, you know, it's fatal for the world, but I'm saying that it could be limiting our views. We could be looking only for certain things, only open to considering certain explanations that we might be able to open our minds to a little bit if we avoided it. But it is difficult to avoid.
Peter, I think you have the last question.
Well, in computation, there's the halting problem, you know, that you can't write a program that tells you when it will stop. You know, do you think that there's a similar type of problem at work here? Can human beings actually model a system in which they are a part?
And we model a system in which that we are a part of.
Can we stand outside of it, in other words? Maybe it's about Alzheimer's.
I think there are some aspects of ourselves that we can model. Our motor movements, we can probably model pretty well. Right, our reproductive dynamics, we can model pretty well. Our incidence of certain types of diseases, we can probably model pretty well. Our motivations, I don't think we can model well.
All right, let's thank Cassandra for her tour.